Welcome to another episode of At Any Rate. My name is Sam Mazzarello, and I lead content strategy for global research. And today's episode, we're going to be having a discussion on central bank policy divergence. I'm thrilled to be joined by Bruce Kasman, Chief Global Economist, Meera Chandon, Co-Head of Global FX Strategy, Ayako Fujita, Chief Japan Economist, and Greg Fusi, Chief European Economist. You're in for a great conversation on global growth and inflation dynamics, where monetary policy is headed, and just how far central bank policy can diverge. I'm going to start by asking Bruce to kick us off with a general view. As a theme, Bruce, how far can central banks really diverge?
Okay, well, let me just, if I could, Sam, start by just giving the thematic points about what's driving the macro outlook. And I think, you know, as we look at the world in 2024, perhaps the most important point is we think the global economy is starting to generate a broader base for sustainable growth. In that regard, I just emphasize that we came into the first quarter and we were surprised materially to the upside. Global GDP is running in Q1 for the countries that have already reported. It seems like about a percentage point above our estimated potential. That's a pretty strong number. We would discount that to some degree. Certainly the China number, which was super strong, is going to come off. But I wouldn't discount what I think we see underneath the surface, which is breath starting to be formed here. To be sure, the U.S. is losing some of its fiscal supports. To be sure, the China strength is going to be moving away from the picture. But what we see is a first quarter in which Western Europe rose from the its slumber, a broader story where consumer spending outside the U.S. is starting to pick up after the U.S. really was the dominant driver of consumption and broader global demand last year, where there is some hints. I think it's more hints than clear-cut signs at this point that global business spending on CapEx is holding up and where generally the labor market data continue to be doing well. So we would just sort of argue that the world is going to grow trend or slightly trend plus. It's going to slow from the first quarter strong pace. And it's going to do reasonably well this year. That's a backdrop for central banks that's important to get on the table. The second point is that we made a big step down in global inflation last year. That obviously encouraged both markets and central banks for a lot of possible easing ahead. But we've been kind of downplaying that. We've felt that inflation was going to make a substantial but incomplete move and that the first part of 2024 was going to show that inflation remains sticky and somewhat elevated. And that's actually what happened. Core inflation, after having moved down from about a 5% pace at the start of 2023 to a 3% pace at the end of 2023, ran 3.5% in the first quarter. I'm taking out China from this calculation. And if you look at what happened in the first quarter, we actually got the U.S., where inflation moved up above a 4% pace, euro area, where it moved up above a 3% pace, as the two real forces that actually had that acceleration. As we go forward from here, we think we're going to stick at around a 3% pace for the next couple of quarters. The dynamics there, I think, importantly, has a global goods price disinflation story that's ending. And I think you can actually see that in the data already. We got a lot of benefits last year from both the fall in commodity prices in the first half, as well as the unwinding of the supply side dislocations, which were a big factor in the upward pressure. Service price inflation is more idiosyncratic, and it's going to feed into this story of divergences quite importantly. I think there's very specific things to say about Japan, about Western Europe, about the U.S., which are individual on that space. But the broader point we just want to make on that front is that inflation in the service space is not being helped by the fact that labor markets are tight, wage costs are elevated, and service sector demand is strong. So that gets me to the central bank story. And the broad point I think we want to make there is that as we look at 2024, this kind of macro backdrop creates limited opportunities for central bank easing. There's just not enough, I think, in terms of the inflation decline to actually argue that central banks can move aggressively. Obviously, there are some high yield central banks in EM that have been able to do more. But I think as we look at the DM, we should be thinking about relatively shallow paths. As you said, there's issue around divergence here. And just to try to be brief on this point, and I want to emphasize that we're expecting convergence and growth. And that, I think, is not as important as it might seem for the central bank story, because I think that convergence and growth is not changing the broader picture that the U.S. has outperformed the rest of the DM in a very significant way. So when you think about U.S. and Western Europe, that growth gap that has been opening up in a persistent way since the start of the pandemic, you could actually say it's been opening up for quite a bit longer than that, and certainly does also reflect structural issues, is probably one of the factors that helps contribute to the divergence. I think, in addition, the inflation gap is also promoting, perhaps somewhat less easing in the U.S. than elsewhere. But I think the basic story here is that there's an opportunity for divergence. But the broad message is that in a world in which growth is overall resilient and the inflation story is still drifting lower, but at a pace that's not really getting you back, at least not as we move through the first few quarters of 24, to something that central banks are quite comfortable with, it's leaving you with a relatively limited room for easing overall. So I'll stop there. I know we obviously want to get more into the divergence issue, but let me stop at this point and bring it back to you, Sam.
Thanks, Bruce. So that level sets very, very well, the global dynamics, inflation and growth, and high level thematic. Just to roadmap a bit, we're starting to get some questions, so keep sending those in and we will get to them. I want to now go through the different central banks and then go to Mira to have her talk through the market pricing perspective. Has there been a divergence between central bank guidance versus market pricing versus the data we've seen? So why don't we start with the ECB, then we'll do BOJ, then we'll end with Fed. So Greg, talk us through ECB. What's your view on rate cuts? What direction do the risks swing? Talk us through that.
Yeah, so I mean, on the ECB, I loosened up the path for the coming year almost. So going to quarterly cuts effectively. They have dug in incredibly hard for June. It's hard to see that not happening, given that we only have basically one more inflation print and then the staff forecasts to come. And I mean, they must be getting internal updates on how those forecasts could be shaping up. Certainly would have got something at the April meeting, and they just haven't been signaling any shift away from the strong rhetoric for June. So that seems to be pretty much baked in. But as I said, I did loosen up the path afterwards. I already had a skip in July, so and then basically quarterly cuts at the staff forecast meetings for a while. In terms of risks, I mean, you know, I do agree with the ECB's direction of travel, and that's, you know, reflected in the forecast. I think there is a good chance that inflation does eventually slow down to 2%, even if the near-term visibility on that path is still quite low. And as Bruce said, some of the incoming inflation data have been on the firm side, especially on services, that does still look sticky. But there is progress in a broader sense. You know, the GDP deflator slowed. There is some slowing in the wage data and so on. And I think that keeps the path more or less on track. But the risks are that growth is going to do a bit better than we think, not necessarily in a problematic way for the ECB, because their growth forecast already is firmer than ours. So the pressure for them is a bit more nuanced in terms of, you know, is that pickup in GDP growth going to generate strong jobs growth? They think no, and it will result in stronger productivity growth. There isn't much sign of that in the data, which biases unit labor cost growth higher, and probably also gives you a bit of upside risk in terms of the near-term inflation momentum. But given how far they've dug in for June, it's not clear that those surprises are going to derail the near-term path.
Great. Ayako, can you talk us through BOJ guidance and the latest Japan outlook?
Sure. BOJ has not provided clear guidance, actually, how quickly they're going to bring the policy rate back to neutral. But, you know, at the press conference after the April policy meeting, actually, Ueda hinted that actually, he has a kind of actually, image that actually, you know, the policy rate will be probably around the neutral level in the second half of the BOJ's forecast horizon. So assuming that R star is around 0.5 minus 0.5%, then actually, you know, the policy rate is bringing back to 1.5, around 1.5% at this point, actually by mid-2026. So 2 years of time, 1%, 1.5%, actually, you know, policy rate hike, it actually seems to be very, very gradual. But you know, this is a kind of actually like probably base case scenario for BOJ if actually, you know, things, you know, continue to evolve as BOJ expects. But we see a little bit of risk to this actually BOJ's actually gradual strategy, because you know the country actually, because of actually is very slow and not, seems to be a little bit of behind the curve BOJ strategy. So we are facing a little bit of pressure from the currency market. So actually, you know, I will probably ask Shimira how she, you know, she thinks about it. But you know, in this actually, you know, because of this actually currency pressure, and of course it's a relatively strong as an expected global backdrop, you know, the BOJ starts seeing a little bit of upside risk to inflation. So more recently, actually BOJ started to hint there is a possibility for BOJ to move a little bit earlier than hinted, or earlier than actually they preferred. So that means actually, you know, probably, you know, currently I'm expecting BOJ to deliver another rate hike in July, actually bringing policy rate back, you know, from 0 to 10 basis points to 25 basis points, and also another rate hike in December. So it's, you know, policy rate to reach to 50, you know, 50 basis points by year end. So that seems to be probably a little bit actually earlier move compared to actually, you know, the kind of actually BOJ's basic plan actually hinted by actually governor. But no, that's clearly actually, you know, the kind of actually, you know, things actually, you know, that, you know, probably, you know, BOJ will be forced to deliver at this point. That's my expectation.
Okay, thanks, Ayako. Bruce, do you want to walk us through the Fed view?
Sure. So I think the Fed view is relatively straightforward at this point, which is the Fed came into this year with a fair amount of optimism that inflation would be on a significant downward trajectory and that that would open the door for material easing. They've been holding to a forecast that they can deliver three easings. But you've seen, as we've gone through the first quarter, both the data flow with core inflation running considerably above their expectations, and the growth numbers, while not being strong in GDP terms, holding up in terms of job growth, they've started to lose some confidence in that. And that's what they've been expressing, certainly Powell's expressing. And I think the bigger point here is twofold. One is what they're telling us is that they're going to need to have, you know, quite a bit more progress on inflation or some kind of a growth scare to really deliver on what is the three easing they have in the forecast right now. And in fact, the committee is pretty divided if you look at where they had gotten to already at the March meeting. So I think those three are underwater. Of course, the market is pricing in right now, probably a touch less than two. And I think we're in a situation where the Fed is basically in a waiting mode in order to see whether or not its narrative for the year that inflation is on a downward trajectory will reestablish itself. We still have forecasted a high side April number for core CPI, and we are thinking that the numbers are going to stay firm enough with our forecast for the second quarter having over a 3% annualized pace for core CPI and core PCE, which is going to make it hard for them to think about easing anytime soon. However, the second point, and I think it is an important point, is that Powell last week came across to us and basically said that while the Fed is less confident it can ease, and it's going to have to be patient here with thinking about what's actually happening on inflation, that it's going to be even more patient in terms of anything that could come into the picture that might actually suggest that they may hike. So the Fed has put a pretty narrow range, I think, on the potential outcomes for the next 6 to 12 months, where it's still hopeful it can ease, but not confident. And it's very strongly pushing against the idea that anything in terms of upside surprises on inflation will get them to tighten. I guess the last point I should just make here is they're also making it very clear that if they started to get scared about growth, if there was something that produced a meaningful negative shock, whether it be on the growth data itself or on the financial market side, that they're willing to move even if inflation stays elevated. So I think overall, this is a cautious central bank, but it's still broadly speaking on the dovish side in terms of the way they're talking to us.
Okay. Mira, based on all of that conversation, there is so much I could ask you. I know you've been writing every week about the yen, divergence, et cetera. Talk Talk us through what you think are the most salient points around the divergence conversation or anything else you've been emphasizing to clients.
Sure. So I think divergence is clearly playing out. We see that most evident in rate markets, for example, where you have just under two cuts priced in for the Fed, three for the ECB, and then a few tens of basis points for the BOJ, but too high. But in the grand scheme of things, I think what we have to remember is that there is some certain amount of synchronicity between the central bank moves here, because at the end of the day, even though growth is coming out a bit more resilient than expected, inflation is also falling, perhaps not as much as central banks would have liked, but certainly, you know, if it's coming off the peak, it is giving most central banks, at least directionally, a dovish bias. And now we are talking about the timing. And of course, in the case of Fed, you know, I think it's a little bit more of an intense problem than it is for some of the other central banks. But I think, you know, we've sort of come back to, so the first thing is, you know, this is a synchronized manner, a cycle. The second thing is policy divergence within that can take place. But I think it's going to be more about timing rather than, you know, unless we get a really firm inflation print and that those continue and we're talking about Fed hikes, you know, that's when it really starts to fall apart, and I think the dollar can go substantially higher. But I think, you know, even in that scenario, the other central banks are not going to be immune to what the Fed is doing. If the Fed can't really cut very much, I think given the currency channel, given the financial markets channel and the sentiment channel, these central banks either might be forced to sort of not cut as much or let their currencies weaken. So I think, you know, if we say we're avoiding a recession, the Fed doesn't have to hike, there is really limits to how much divergence that can open up between central banks. So we're looking for, I'd say, under the current circumstances, relatively, you know, your narrow ranges for currencies like euro dollar, where, you know, we think 105 to 111, 112 seems like the appropriate range. We're more bearish within that spectrum, 105. But really, if we have to go well below 105 to say towards parity for euro dollar, you know, we have to look at new things that are coming into play, whether that is Fed having to hike or whether that's some geopolitical risk, or potentially in other terms of trade shock or a recession in Eurozone. I think that's when we're talking about parity. The last thing I'll say is, you know, central banks have been pushing back hard. Obviously, the guidance, you know, makes a big difference for FX, but I think a lot also depends clearly on the credibility that the markets are attaching to various central banks. And clearly, you know, as far as the Fed is concerned, if you take a look at the price action of Q1, it's very clear. It didn't really matter how dovish Powell was in his comments. At the end of the day, you know, markets priced off of actual data, the inflation data, the growth data, and more importantly, the inflation data, because there was a premise there and a credibility that the Fed's going to do the right thing by inflation. And I think, you know, you can even see that despite the dovish leanings from Powell, even at the last meeting, I think the upcoming inflation report is actually going to be quite critical. So I would say for central banks, you know, where ultimately there is a lot of inflation credibility, you have to focus on the data rather than the central bank guidance. But, you know, you sort of skip ahead to announce somewhat controversially to the BOJ, where, you know, I think actually what the central bank is saying matters a lot because it's adjusting how much credibility the market can actually attach to the response function to rising inflation. And what we've seen in Japan is real yields have gotten more and more negative as inflation has gone up without a policy response. So with that, and, you know, with the dovish stance, central bank maintaining a dovish stance, not showing any urgency to move, that's when you start to see that the release valve becomes very impactful for the currency. So I think the central bank's talks can only take you so far, and divergences can only go so far.
Excellent. Then Bruce, to bounce off of that, you spoke to divergence as a theme. Do you now want to speak to divergence with respect to magnitude? What's possible?
Feasible? Well, I tend to agree with Mira, which is to say, unless we're really talking about economies that have major differences in growth cycles, there's clearly room for divergence here, but I think the room is limited. And, you know, I think in some ways the basic issue on divergence here is, I think that when you step away from the very near term, where we do have some growth convergence going on between the US and the rest of the world, what you're in right now is an environment in which the US has had a much stronger demand side performance for a long period of time. The US has had also a stronger supply side performance, and I think those two things are connected. Western Europe has had very weak demand and very weak supply. And we're struggling, I think, to to kind of judge how the balance of those things play out in terms of where we are on the inflation side. And I think they play out in two ways on the central bank side. One is, I think it should give, as you can hear Greg talking, it should give you somewhat more confidence that over time, Western European inflation will move lower. It's by no means assured. Again, the weak supply side piece of this does matter. But if we're kind of looking over the next 12, 18 months, not losing sight of the fact that labor costs are still running high in the region, the weakness in demand, the persistence of weak pricing power, the unwind of the energy and other supply shocks does give you some more confidence. And I think the second point is that if you're the central bank and you're sitting there making judgments about that, if you're the Fed and you've had such a strong economy, if you still have strong job growth, and obviously there are risks on where that goes, the strong growth both raises questions about where your neutral rate is. And secondly, it also raises issues around risk. You're much more comfortable being patient, watching sticky inflation, and not having to make a strong judgment that you could threaten your expansion, and therefore take your time and wait. And I think in terms of the way we think about Western Europe, and in some of the reasons why I think they starting earlier here, is both you don't have that story that says, hey, we've had strong growth, maybe our star number is much higher. And secondly, you don't want to be as patient in a world in which you've been almost flirting with recession for most of the last year, year and a half, even if the growth numbers are good. So the growth backdrop, more about the cumulative gaps, I think does matter for central banks. I think it's harder to be cocky and confident on it, but I do think it matters for inflation. And therefore, I think it does drive the divergence story. However, having said that, if we're broadly right that Europe is waking from its slumber, if we're broadly right that the U.S. economy is cooling somewhat, not going to have the same outperformance, and if we're broadly right that, well, we might have inflation moving lower in the euro area, nobody's getting inflation back to 2% anytime soon, I think the action you get on divergences is modest. It's not huge. And I think in that context, we also have to put important weight on the fact that the Fed has thrown cold water on the idea that overshoots on inflation actually bring tightening into the conversation anytime soon. So I think there's every reason to see divergence. I think that's what we're starting to have unfold here. The European central banks are on the move. And I think that divergence obviously will continue, but I think it's limited without something really surprising on the growth cycle. Obviously, if the U.S. would fall into recession and Europe wouldn't, we could flip the switch on this thing. And if Europe fell into recession and the U.S. didn't, we're going to get great divergence. But unless you throw into the picture a much bigger growth story, I think there's a case for Europe doing more than the U.S. is not a case for a very big divide here in terms of how far we go on that road.
Okay, so we've gotten a slew of client questions. I do want to make sure that we go back to Ayako and Mira to talk about the yen, because there's been a lot moving and shaking there. To start, there's an interesting question around the history of divergence. Is there any parallels with central banks cutting before the Fed in the past? I don't know, Mira, do you want to take that? I know you used to cover rates in more depth.
I mean, look, it comes down to very specific sort of cyclical circumstances. But let's take ECB as an example. Since the inception of the Eurozone in 1999, and that's a limited sample set, admittedly, but you've had in rate cutting cycles actually Fed lead the way. Lower first, and the ECB tends to lag. So typically, if you do any sort of analysis around what happens to euro dollar and what happens to rate differentials in favor of euro, they tend to start moving very quickly in favor of euro as the Fed starts cutting. So a lot of people have sort of taken that historical context and have started to sort of apply that even to this current episode, and have assumed that euro dollar should be heading higher. But obviously, 2024 has shown that actually history doesn't always hold true to that. It does depend on the circumstances. And in this situation, we are heading into a cycle where the ECB is going to start before the Fed. I think similarly, if you take a look at, broadly speaking, take a step back and sort of take a look at the global backdrop, you know, what we saw, which was interesting in the last hiking cycle, is that about half the central banks globally, and this was predominantly EM, had already hiked rates before the Fed started hiking. That was actually highly unusual as well. And you know, equally now what we've seen in this cycle is, as you know, EM central banks have already been cutting. We've only had two rate cuts from the DM so far. We had the SMB back in March, and we had the Riksbank this week from Sweden. So, you know, what we've also had is EM central banks again preempt the Fed. And I think what we've seen is that post-COVID, you know, the patterns in inflation, first the pickup and now the synchronized deceleration, has basically turned the head on what people might have expected previously. And that's the reason why, when the Fed started hiking, because EM had already hiked, actually that those currencies, emerging market currencies, were actually fairly insulated and didn't really get much affected by the Fed hiking cycle. You know, the currencies that got affected the most were DM. So I think it's a cyclical context. Usually Fed tends to lead, but this is not the case this time around. Okay. Unless now we're, the last thing I'll say on that is, unless we get to a point where market now has to price in a Fed hike because of stickier inflation in the US, I think that's when, you know, it's going to be leading again, because it's going to force other central banks perhaps to limit policy easing at their end.
So that's actually, there's a perfect corollary question that came in from a client on that, on sticky inflation. So Bruce, I'll direct this to you. Are there any concerns for U.S. growth later in the year if sticky inflation ultimately leads to problems with real incomes and spending if wage growth continues to ease as the labor market loosens? So that chain of events.
Yeah, so I think there's every reason to think about a world in which sticky inflation and elevated policy rates is a weight on the economy. In some ways, we've been thinking about this in the context of a narrative we've been calling boil the frog, which is that this force actually does start to create some vulnerabilities. And I think part of the channel which was described is the idea that if higher interest rates do present some drag on growth and you end up with sticky inflation there, you might end up with a dynamic in which real incomes start to get eaten away at. There's other parts of those channels that work through balance sheet adjustment, through tighter credit. You can see in the latest senior loan officer survey that banks are still tightening credit conditions. And I think, you know, that's one force here. The other force here, which I think is going in the other direction, is we're generating wealth. We're in a world in which we're continuing to see jobs expand, even if they're not going to be at quite that pace. And I think overall financial conditions have not responded to the higher interest rates in terms of tightening more broadly. So there's, you know, one of the things we've been struggling with in our own mind is we don't think the U.S. economy is poised to continue to grow at over the 3% pace it did over the last four quarters. But it doesn't look to us right now that those forces that would weigh on growth are going to dominate to the degree that they create any kind of material recession risk. Let me throw one caveat into this, or one extra element into this, which bears on what we said a few minutes ago. When we were talking about divergences in policy and saying there's room, but there's not as much room for very wide divergences, I think that needs to be kind of also taken into context, not just of what our forecast for central bank action is, but also for where markets are priced. So if you think about market pricing over the next 18 months or so, the market has the Fed and the ECB both moving roughly 130 basis points right now. So if we think about a world in which the ECB may move, I don't know what, let's just say four times, just for throw, that's not our forecast. But if the Fed doesn't move or moves once, then, you know, that gap doesn't look dramatic by any kind of standards of behavior when viewed, certainly in the context of how much tightening we've had over the last 2 or 3 years. But that's going to have a very big impact on the pricing as you look out along the curve, more than the next 6 or 9 months, but looking out over the next couple of years. If we begin to take out Fed easing, but continue to have ECB easing, the impact from a market point of view will be more substantial than what might be looking like a more modest divergence in actual policy actions over the next 6 to 12 months.
Okay, then again, good segue to a client question, taking divergence all the way out and thinking about terminal rates. So Greg, Ayako, I'll come to you both on this. How different do you think terminal rates can be between the US, the ECB, the BOJ? And Bruce already touched a little bit on our star, but are neutral rates in these economies fundamentally diverging? Greg, let's start with you, and then Ayako, can you talk to that idea as well?
Sorry, I had to unmute myself. I mean, our star estimates are obviously subject to a lot of uncertainty, and they do come kind of ebb and flow potentially with the performance of the economy. So if you're doing very well with a policy rate at 4, then your view about our star might drift higher. I think that's a point that Bruce was making earlier. I mean, we haven't had that kind of pressure to reassess in a big way yet in the euro area because growth hasn't been that strong. The ECB's estimates have kind of gone from, I don't know, 1.5 back up towards 2 in terms of their neutral rate estimates. That's kind of where I have been as well. That's my assumption effectively, and it hasn't really changed.
But I think it's important, Greg, just to point out that I think most people's estimates of where the Fed neutral rate, which is, you know, set at 2.6 for them in the SEP, is probably somewhere between 3% and 4%. So that's a pretty big gap between where you are and where I think most people would be for the US at this point.
Yep.
Ayako, maybe terminal rate isn't as relevant because there's other BOJ policy still very much at play. So why don't you talk us through some of that? Let's go a little deeper on Japan, and then Mira will come to you. Can you talk through the yen view?
So I can just a little bit talk about the neutral rate for Japan, because you know our working assumption of neutral rate is about negative 0.5%, and BOJ recently hinted to us that actually their estimate is around, you know, between somewhere from negative 1% to positive, you know, 0.5%. And there seems to be a kind of discussion within the BOJ, and we kind of agree that actually, you know, for the short term, actually, you know, our neutral rate seems to be a little bit lower than actually previous estimate, because, you know, despite the strong monetary accommodation, actually domestic growth remains quite weak. So therefore, actually, you know, the BOJ seems to be think that actually, okay, probably neutral rate, actually, you know, for the short term means probably, you know, for coming years, maybe a little bit lower than the previous estimate. So in that, you know, kind of argument in place, actually, you know, that justifies some actually the dovishness of BOJ in terms of actually, you know, process of policy normalization.
Thanks, Ayako. Mira.
Yeah, on the currency, look, the BOJ came across as very dovish in the last meeting. They had every opportunity, given the pressures on the currency, to do something, whether it was to adjust JGB purchases or, you know, or talk about the currency a bit more, emphasize it, emphasize more potential for rate hikes. But I think overall the read was that there was very little sensitivity against currency weakness. And I think what that does, it does two things. Firstly, it's pretty clear to me that, and at least, you know, from talking to market participants as well, that the risk here is that given the persistently negative real yields, which is the worst globally and getting more negative, that the currency is going to have to be the release valve here, particularly if US rates continue to head higher. Now, I think, you know, just like we saw in 2022, after the Ministry of Finance actually intervened twice, first in September, then in October, they got really lucky because US yields actually plummeted. And dollar yen fell quite a bit because of that. And yen was able to regain a footing. But if the next inflation report in the US is actually firmer than expected and US yields are repricing higher, the 40 or 50 basis points that are priced in for the Fed for this year are getting taken out, the moves in dollar yen are just going to be explosive to the upside. And I think what we've also learned is that the Ministry of Finance, you know, what's guiding them is essentially the pace of currency weakening rather than absolute levels. But we know that till about 160, from where we are right now in the mid 150s to 160, is relatively a clean, clear runway So I think generally speaking, you know, our base case has been, you know, mid 150s, you know, so 155 for dollar yen. But I would say that given what we've learned, there is asymmetric risk to the upside if US yields head higher. And I think Ayako has done a fantastic research note a few days ago, just talking about, for the central bank, what is really going to be the least painful policy measure. Is it that they're going to be willing to raise rates by 100 basis points, for example, to defend the currency, or will they just let the currency weaken? And it seems, you know, her work is also showing that within that trade-off of policies, they'd rather let the currency go rather than you know, hike by a lot to stem that. And by the way, like, even if they hike 40, 50 basis points, if the Fed's really not doing very much, that 4.5%, 5% yield gap is still too wide to call, you know, to sort of warrant a dollar yen decline.
Okay, as we start to wrap, Bruce, a question came through to you around the inflation target of the Fed. Could there be a world or a scenario where the Fed actually will want to revise its inflation target?
I think the short answer to that is, if we're talking about the stated target, is no. I think they've invested too much in anchoring inflation expectations and have a very strong belief that somewhere around 2% is probably the right place to be. I think where we're getting far more kind of interesting pieces of the Fed reaction function is how they manage a path towards a long-term average of 2%. And of course, as I think everybody knows, in 2020, they changed their framework and put in the flexible average inflation targeting framework, which goes a long way towards showing that the Fed is really trying to maintain that inflation target over a long period of time. It's not trying to achieve it in any specific time frame. I think more to the immediate issue is, if you listen to the way Powell spoke to us last week with the idea that he seems to be suggesting the Fed will be willing to accept some modest but persistent overshoot of inflation without having the Fed think about hiking, is, I think, a message that says that they're not really trying to get inflation down to 2% anytime quickly. I guess the way I would put it together in terms of thinking about the Fed's reaction function is, I think that they will need to feel comfortable that inflation is on a path to move below 2.5% to start easing from what they believe is a restrictive policy stance. That's where they were at the start of the year, with a 2.4% inflation forecast for 2024 and a 2.2% inflation forecast for 2025. As you move those numbers into the mid twos, 2.5, 2.6, whatever, you start to get a more difficult time for thinking about easing, but you're not putting in tightening. In the March FOMC meeting, they kept the tightening easing of 3 times for 2024, but they pushed their 24 forecast up to 2.6, but kept the 25 at 2.2. I think the risk now is that they start to push the 25 forecast up to 2.5 or a little bit higher, which I think, from the context of the way the market should look at it, is that that's going to start to take out the easing path as we look at 2025. However, that's not a Fed that's going to actively move to tighten to try to bring inflation down. So they will have tolerance for that. I think to get the Fed to talk about tightening in a way that they actually act on it, I think you have to have them look at their forecast and say, hey, we're going to get stuck here at 3% or higher over a period of time. So there's a lot of flexibility here. Some of that, I think, is part of the recognition on the Fed's part that came after the last 20 years, that inflation can actually be too low if it undershoots 2% by too much, and a recognition that if that's the case, then at the more mature phases of the expansion, you probably do want inflation to be averaging somewhat above 2%, because when the recession comes, it's going to do a decent amount of your work in terms of bringing inflation lower.
Okay, we're almost at time. And then I find when we're almost at time is when we start to get a lot of questions. So just maybe one more for Ayako and Mira. Given the latest public comments from the BOJ, persistent pressure on the yen, Do you see the BOJ making any monetary response soon, or do you expect yen intervention to continue? And correct me if I'm wrong, it's never confirmed, correct, about yen intervention? It's just rumor, or we know it's happening? Okay. Ayako's nodding. Ayako, go ahead.
Yeah, in terms of intervention, actually, some actually unnamed officials actually mentioned that was the intervention, but actually Kanda did not admit it. So that's the case, actually, the recent intervention, but you know, maybe actually Mira knows better than that. But anyway, in terms of monetary policy response, I think actually commentary suggested that actually, you know, the BOJ policy members has broadly agreed to deliver actually QT part of the decision. The deduction of JGB purchases, actually, because there are actually some opinions actually referring to, you know, potential reduction of JGB purchase. And all of the opinions, you know, basically agree that the BOJ need to decide the clear direction of the reduction of JGB purchases. That actually, we expect this decision will be delivered in June meeting. But in terms of policy response, actually, policy-led response, it's still not very clear, based on the opinion. So because opinion suggested the risk of moving faster compared to their plan, but it's still some members still prefer to monitor their domestic economic indicator, which remains quite weak, but more very cautiously. So it's still under the discussion, but risk is skewed a little bit earlier move, of course, but there are no clear signal at this point.
Mira, would you add anything?
Yeah, I'd say on interventions, well, it's the Ministry of Finance, not the BOJ, and we can infer based on some daily data. If they're intervening by $1 or $2 billion, that's not really going to show up in that, but we can infer on the basis of some daily data what the intervention amount might have been, and certainly the price action in dollar yen can sort of reflect that. So we're estimating based on the daily data that there was about $55 billion of intervention last week. That was spread out over a 3-day period, so it technically qualifies as one intervention episode by the IMF. And the official intervention data is going to come out with a lag. I'd say Ministry of Finance interventions, you know, what our local strategists and, who cover the Japanese yen have been saying is basically that if dollar yen decouples from, underlying drivers such as US rate differentials, or the pace of the move is highly excessive, that's when the Ministry of Finance comes in, not necessarily, they're not hung up on some particular level. So what you can see is that the Monday post GAJ, when the Ministry of Finance did come in the Tokyo session, it was actually US yields didn't really move that much, but dollar yen actually sprang higher to 160, and that was sort of qualified as the first intervention episode. So I think it's more about pace and the context rather than some particular level. And the last thing I'll say is intervention shouldn't continue forever because it's usually not effective if the underlying reasons as to why the currency is weak stay intact. So the reason that the currency weakened at the end of the day is because the markets have rethought the Fed and the BOJ has clearly been dovish and not changed its policy. So this is actually a policy driven and motivated or inspired yen weakness, if you will. So they can intervene to smooth out the volatility and action, but actually this is a direct outcome of the policy divergence story. So don't really think they'd want to be spending a lot of money on this. And it's not going to be effective if that's the direction in any case.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of At Any Rate. This podcast was recorded on May 9th, 2024. This communication is provided for information purposes only. Please refer to JP Morgan research reports related to its content for more information, including important disclosures. 2024 JPM Chase & Co., all rights reserved.